You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hello and welcome to the Break a Bat podcast, where baseball meets Broadway. An attempt to show that my two favorite mediums don't have to live in such separate worlds and maybe even break some stigmas. We're happy to have you with us. Now let's play ball. Hello and welcome to Break a Bat. I'm your host, Al Malafronte, coming at you for the Broadway Podcast Network. This one's a special show for me, as today we're lucky enough to be joined by probably one of my favorite people in show business. He originally made a name for himself as the host of The Soup on E! He then went on to star Community. And he's currently the host of ABC's Card Sharks. The second season of the show's revival is set to premiere on Sunday, October 18th. And in addition to everything he's accomplished on screen, he's also a tremendous sports fan with a particular love for his hometown, Seattle Mariners, as he nods his head along to that. So it's a real honor to have him join us tonight. With that being said, if you'll please turn your attention to home plate. Just beyond the marquee, now batting, Joel McHale. Welcome to Break a Bat.
Great to be here on deck. It's a very weird background. It's a very weird baseball field, Ron.
I mean, you've been so busy, man, but I see, you know, I guess LA's rubbed off on you a little bit because you have like one of those makeshift Laker shirts going on. You jumped on the LA sports bandwagon, I see.
Yeah, just a couple days ago, I got on the bandwagon. I decided it was okay. For the last few days celebrating the comfort behind Seahawks' incredible victory on Sunday. And then, of course, the Storm, Seattle Storm won the championship last week. And then I was like, I didn't have like a Lakers scarf. And so I just decided to find some yellow tape. And I should have used some purple tape too. So it was a great sports week for me.
And you've been pretty busy throughout this whole pandemic. I mean, between the Tiger King special, you launched your own podcast, and you know, you have the second season of Card Sharks coming up. I mean, I got to give you props, man. It's nice that you've been able to stay so busy. I'm sure we're all certainly grateful for it.
Oh, well, that's not true. But I am a workaholic, obsessive compulsive person who has ADHD and cannot sit still. And I usually go into like extreme anxiety when I'm on vacation. My whole thing was that, well, all the A-list celebrities are going to use this as a vacation, and the D-lists, we will step in and grab some of the attention.
You say D-list, come on. You're not giving yourself enough credit, man.
D+.
So let me ask you, I mean, you've been in the industry for like 25 years now. You're as great as they come as far as hosts go. Was it challenging to shoot Card Sharks during the pandemic?
Well, it shut down. We were supposed to shoot it in February, and that's when shit got real. And we literally had it, day before stopped. And that was frustrating, but necessary. And then we were one of the first shows to come back, which was really cool. And it's now industry practice, but back in July, I don't know who came up with it, but there were all these zones. People weren't allowed to travel in and out. And we had a positive test, a COVID test, we thought. It turned out to be it was inconclusive, and then it was a negative. But at the time, it was like, oh, shit, we have a positive test on set. And Fremantle, the production company, was they had already, you know, they were like, we're not going to shut down. We're going to figure out how to deal with it. And it was a great plan, and it worked. They had the whole zone removed. They brought in the news, I don't know what you would call it, the next squad to replace them. They got contact traced, and they found out it was a negative, but at the time, it was like a 3-hour delay, and then we were shooting again.
Now, during the first season, you said how much joy it brings you to see folks win big money like that. Was it even more gratifying this season, given the times we're in?
Well, also the rules slightly changed. So it's a little bit easier to win more money. And then the people started winning so much more money that ABC was like, what's going on? And I don't know how happy they were, but they made a lot of people really happy. And I don't have emotions anymore. I barely get excited about anything. But when people are winning that kind of money, you can win up to $700,000. People's lives are being changed. It's pretty incredible. And then the heartbreaking, like there was some dude, he lost out on hundreds of thousands to be just a turn of a card. And it was I felt so bad for him. And then I, you know, was like, all right, get the fuck out. No, I didn't. But I really do. It's such a simple game in the best way. It's just turning cards over and the money just gets higher and higher if you don't screw it up or if the cards fall in your favor. So, it's very simple, but the stakes get really bananas.
Now, the guy who lost out on all that money, it wasn't sort of like have you ever seen like with Deal or No Deal where these people have the opportunity to walk away with six figures, they yell no deal, they lose all their money and they're still dancing with like the $50 that they walk away with. Was it kind of like that situation?
No, that guy walked away with nothing. There is an option. Like you can double, you know, you keep doubling your money and there is an option at one point to leave. And a couple people did that, but that's not as fun as risking it. But I understand. So a couple people did opt out, but it's funny to see people like they're on TV, they're gambling. And a lot of people are like, fuck it, let's do it. And it's great.
It's awesome. I think you did such a great job in the first season and I can't wait for Sunday. I mentioned in the intro, by the way, that you're a big Mariners fan and I got to give you props, I got to give the Mariners props. They certainly performed a lot better than people expected this year, but this year actually marks the 25th anniversary of the team that saved baseball in Seattle. And, you know, when you look back on it now, you know, Edgar Martinez and Griffey and Randy Johnson, what's the lasting memory for you?
Well, you know, the famous one in the kingdom when they made it, went further in the playoffs and they all tackled each other and Griffey was on the bottom smiling and the city was going bananas. And because the Mariners had always, just a few seasons later after we lost Rodriguez and Griffey and Johnson, we won 116 games. I think that was 2000. And then we of course got knocked out, but Seattle has always been I grew up in the Seattle before Microsoft, Starbucks and Amazon. And it was when we actually had a professional basketball team and our city was kind of this backwater and was, you know, like big bands just would go from San Francisco to Vancouver and skip us. So we always were scrappy and we always fought, and our team, the only championship team we had was the Sonics in 79-80, and they got sold. Thanks, Howard Schultz. So we always kind of felt like the stepchild of our professional sports teams because we weren't that good. We got close in the 80s with Dave Craig's Seahawks. I think we got one game away from the Super Bowl, but people, you know, like East Coast sports gets all the attention always. And so no one paid attention to Seattle. And then when teams started doing well, it was so exciting. And the city, I love LA. I really do. And they love their teams and that's really cool. And I feel bad for the Chargers. Seattle really, I mean, our MLS games sell out, all of them. When you could have an audience. I'm really happy about hockey. The name Kraken is problematic because it's how my friends and I would always say we are about to go take a dump by releasing the Kraken. It's a very long explanation. And it really, you know, I love that city. I haven't lived there in 20 years, but I love it. And I go back all the time. We used to go back all the time. But I, you know, it's a very long explanation to say that Seattle is should have a basketball team, greatest sports town. And when I hear people from Boston and New York say they're the greatest sports town, I'm just like, whatever.
Now, do you hate the New York teams? You know, it's like the Yankees and Mets or the Jets and Giants, because I know you love football too. Like, is there, you know, because in Boston, you can't mention the Yankees. In, you know, in certain parts of California, you know, if you're up north, you can't mention the Dodgers if, you know, you're around Giants fans. So is there hatred for the Yankees?
I know about the Dodgers, but all those other teams you just mentioned, I've never heard of. What cities are they in?
Who, the new, the Flushing Mets, I think they're called.
Don't even know who you're talking about. No, I hate all other sports teams, of course, except for the ones that I love. And no, it's funny. I did go to a Yankees game in the late 90s and I wore a Mariners hat. They were playing the Mariners. And that was my first experience with, I was like, oh, these are New York fans. Now I understand. It's so cool that we live in a country where we can, you know, root for teams we love. That's cool. And I love that. And, you know, like when Tom Brady was dominating with the Patriots, people are like, I hate the Patriots. And it's like, you hate them because they're terrific. And Tom Brady has ice water flowing through his veins. And so whenever people are like, don't you hate them? I'm like, I don't really hate them. I'm glad we're all I hate it when guys get injured during games that are doing well and then the other team wins. That's why I'm just like, well, you got the win, but it's not as cool because the guy who was kicking your ass is out. In conclusion, I watch a lot of sports. I love the bubble. The basketball was great. I mean, it was, yeah. So sports has been a great way to distract from the pandemic. I don't know about college football coming back, but you know, hopefully no one's getting paid there. The guys don't get paid and they're like, I hope you don't get COVID, but good luck. I can talk about this all day long.
Yeah, I know you're such a big fan, so I have to ask you. I know you've accomplished a lot in your career, but a few years ago, the Mariners asked you to throw out the first pitch. How much pressure are you feeling going to the stadium that day?
Well, I've done it twice for them. Yeah, how do you like that?
That's a big deal.
A lot of it is pretty freaking nerve-wracking. I was a baseball pitcher in junior high and 1 year of high school, or I was on the team, so I can puck it pretty hard. Remember Keith Olbermann? So Keith Olbermann taught me, he was like, here's how you throw, you know, in these situations, he goes, just aim it about 3 feet above the catcher's head because you're on the mound and you don't want to be that guy that's in front of the mound. You can if you're a kid or somebody who doesn't know how to throw anything, but he was right. And so I've done that every time. And only one of my first pitches has gone awry. And that was at a White Sox game because I threw it harder. I was like, I'm going to freaking throw this thing. And it was not a great throw. I've been very lucky in that when you aim above, I'm just staring 3 feet above their head and that thing just freaking sinks in there. And so I got very lucky. I've been very lucky. So, but yes, the pressure is ridiculous. And you, when you stand on that mound, you're like, oh, what a dream it would be to be a Major League Baseball player.
You see Fauci's first pitch?
That was really bad.
I was going to say he couldn't do worse than that, but he's obviously got some pretty big fish to fry right now.
I know that Trump made fun of him. I'm guaranteed Trump couldn't probably get it across the plate. So I don't even care what your political affiliation is, but you can't make fun of a thing that you can't do too.
Right. Absolutely.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com.
Great expectations.
The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Now, you mentioned your athletic background, and I know in the past you've spoken a little bit about how school was a little bit of a struggle for you when it came to the academics, but you were a top-notch athlete. Was there something about sports that, you know, made you find solace or provided some sort of distraction while you were growing up? And I mean, because obviously you really crushed it. You went on to University of Washington and played football there.
Well, I was a walk-on, so I wasn't like, you know, I wasn't recruited. I didn't play football in high school, so other than 1 year. So that was kind of, it was a very strange, convoluted way for me to get on the team. But I love sports. I love playing them. And I think, yeah, being dyslexic and, you know, like undiagnosed and ADHD and distracted and terrible grades and terrible speller, sports was a thing I could do. And I would play basketball until 4 a.m. and it was where I got confidence, and I was very lucky in that way. And, I played so many different sports that I never really got good at one. That's how I like to look at it. And of all things, I got recruited to be a rower, in college, and, Harvard saw that I was pretty fast, and they looked at me, and then they saw my grades, and they were like, no, you never. But then I left rowing because those guys were assholes. And, I had a bunch of football player friends in college, and they're like, you should come out for football. And I'm like, okay. And that was wonderful 2 years of my life. It really was. I'll look back on it very fondly. And it was so great. It was so fun. I got very lucky because I didn't break, you know, anything or break a knee open or anything like that. So I came out unscathed, other than, you know, getting hit in the head all the time. But other than that, I can barely remember anything.
Well, it helps when you're 6'4" in college. I'm sure that goes a long way too.
It does. It does if you're a tight end.
That's the truth. And now, let me ask you this. Jockey Joel McHale, how does he catch the acting bug while he's in college?
I caught the acting bug in second grade. That's the only thing I ever wanted to do was act and play sports. I probably should have gone into professional wrestling. And that's all I ever wanted to do. And then I did a play in fifth grade. I did a play in seventh. I made a decision in seventh grade that this is what I was going to do with my life. I was like, this is the one for me, God. And I did plays throughout high school. And I probably should have never gone to regular college. Because I knew what I wanted to do. And I was constantly involved in theater and comedy. And I did a lot of improvising in Seattle, a lot of plays. And, So I always had the bug. I, in fact, in college is when I was doing a lot of other things other than acting, because I was so focused on sports and screwing around. So then I really focused and really got back into it. So So it's one of these things where I'm going to do this until the bad acting police arrest me, take me away.
Now, you said that you were acting during school. Were you doing musicals as well?
I did. Oh, yeah. Singing and dancing. I did a bunch in high school. I really enjoyed it. And I never thought, it's funny, like, I never wanted to go to Broadway or anything like that. I didn't have that bug. I really just wanted to be on. I mean, like, I wanted to act on TV. And people are like, oh, how dare you? I love Broadway and plays and stuff like that. And I would do them now, but I don't know if they'd have me. But musicals are really fun. They're really fun to do. I haven't done one in years, but it's funny, like when I would do them in high school and college, they'd be like, you know, you guys just do this as much as you can, because, you know, when you get to the real world, you're not gonna be able to, you know, especially in entertainment, it's like, this is not really gonna happen. You're not gonna do a lot of these things. And the first big gig that I got in LA, or when I got this huge commercial for a Super Bowl commercial where I'm dancing the entire time. And so that was really fun. And I was like, I'm doing the thing. I took dance lessons for a while. So I'm not a good dancer, but I can, you show me the moves, I can remember them and kind of pull it off somewhat.
I think you did a pretty good job. I think it was maybe, 10 years ago, you did that Emmys opening with Fallon and Corey Monteith, like the Born to Run. That was pretty awesome.
Good memory. Jeez. Yeah, we were full on dancing. And I totally fucked that dance up when we got on the live stage. And I looked at Jane Lynch and she was like, I did too. I'm like,
now let me ask you, you know, you mentioned the dyslexia earlier and, you know, when you're embarking on the Hollywood career, with everything that you've had to deal with, as far as that dyslexia goes, is it like always in the back of your mind when you're reading for these parts, or how do you not let the moment get too big?
Oh, well, for when I'm reading for a role, I just memorize it. I became, especially, you know, my memorization skills, they for every actor go up when you're on a show where you're constantly memorizing 40 to 60 pages a week. And so I'm pretty good at it. Especially, it's weird when the writing is good and flows like regular talking dialogue. It's easy to memorize. And so I usually just get off book. But when it came to teleprompter, watch out. I didn't know what the fuck to do. So The Soup, we would take, you know, when The Soup started back in 2005, it would take me like 3.5 hours, 4 hours to finally get through 22 minutes of dialogue, you know, 22 minutes of teleprompter. And I thought, oh, never was really diagnosed. So they literally told me I was a slow starter, which is not a scientific term. Yeah, then my sons got diagnosed with it. And I was like, hey, you're describing all my symptoms. Like what I do. And they're like, yeah, well, we're just trying to figure out we knew it was one of you because that's how it's passed down. It took me a long time. So I had a lot of anxiety. And so I would get really, I would look at these scripts like freaking like so much. I would practice them. So when I finally got on camera, I could figure out how to make sure that I like there's certain words to get through, but you guys didn't see it very much, but I would fuck up the script all the time and I would just have to compensate by correcting myself. So, there was some takes that I would just be, so I got to the point where I'm like, I'm just going to screw it up and let's just keep that. But when it would come to the pressure of something like, something like when I hosted the ESPYs, that was like 8 minutes of jokes. And, you know, you're in there, my computer's dying. You're in there and that's when I had to be like, take your time. You know these words, you know these jokes. And it's funny when I would screw up a joke, it became more endearing. To the audience, they're like, oh, look at him, Scooter. It's okay. That's why I think The Soup ended up working, is because under the guise of keeping everything casual, it allowed me to screw up. That was a really long explanation.
No, I think I very well said. Now I know you're a Seattle kid through and through. Life obviously changes a lot after The Soup. Are you comfortable with fame? Are you comfortable with the Hollywood lifestyle, or did it take some time to adjust to that?
The Hollywood lifestyle? Yeah. All the time. Sometimes I love my Apple Watch, but sometimes I fucking hate the sounds.
Do you work for Apple Watch? Was that a plug right there that you did, Joel?
Apple Watch, brought to you by Squadcast. what am I saying? What was the question?
So I was just asking, you know, being a Seattle kid, are you, you know, once The Soup happens, obviously life changes and you're comfortable with the fame?
Yeah, I mean, but my level of fame is not, you know, I'm trying to think of like, I've been around people that are insanely famous and that is, they can't really go out. They can go out, but they're followed everywhere. It's bananas, and they need to have fences up around their homes. So I never experienced that level of fame. There was a time in Seattle, yes, I would be recognized a lot. It's not as much, you know, when you're on TV, you get recognized a lot. When you're not on TV, it drops off quick. But now, like, since I've been on The Masked Singer and a couple other shows, or like Tiger King alone, I was like, oh, that's what it feels like. So, what am I saying? I don't ever want to go back. I like it. And when I see celebrities that are, I mean, I understand some people are introverts, and that's, and when they talk about them, it's a bummer for them. I kind of understand, but if you're recognized for something you do well, I mean, I'm too bad, I guess, but congrats. It's a certain measure of what you're doing. Obviously, if you're a serial killer, it's a bad reason to be famous, but I don't mind it. I don't think about it. When I go out, it's not like I'm like, oh boy, I better make sure I look good. And, you know, and all, I don't do any, yeah, I think people imagine that stuff. And, I don't know. It's, I don't ever want to go back. Yeah. Yeah. And I like when I hear people go like, isn't it about who, you know, I'm like, yeah, every business is that way. You end up knowing people in your business. Like, lawyers know lawyers, and surgeons know surgeons, and actors and performers know each other. So when people are like, you go to these Hollywood parties, I'm like, with people that work in Hollywood, yes, that's usually how it works. I don't go to the, I don't know, like sailboat, you know, riggers on sailboats, they have their own parties probably, and everyone knows each other. So anyway, that's my long explanation. Again, cheers.
Cheers to that. What are you drinking over there today, Joel?
Well, we got some Soda Stream going. Look at that.
Oh, okay. I raise you with water and a nice Yeti, you know, real.
Yeah, thank God you have like a bulletproof cup, because you wouldn't want that thing to get punctured during the thing. You just never know.
I know. I'm more worried about the, I live in a studio apartment. You don't have that much room for stuff. I have like a Keurig, like right next to the laptop. A little nervous about that, but the Yeti, yeah, nothing's getting through this thing.
Very good problem to have.
Now, I do want to mention Community, obviously, one of my favorite shows. You hinted recently that you'd be open to possibly doing a revival. Do you see that revival including Chevy Chase?
We did not hint at that at all. That is a thing that the cast said they would do when we did that live read. I don't know. Chevy left the show pretty unceremoniously. So, and then, you know, we had people like Jonathan Banks and Paget Brewster and Keith David come in and really bring the house down. So I don't know. I really don't know about that, but it ended pretty crazily with him. So I would be surprised, but Stranger Things.
You guys always seem to have a pretty good relationship, though.
Chevy is Chevy, and he is, can be pretty tough on set. And so, we all learn to work together. But he even said it in 1,000 different articles that he didn't like the hours. And he always said he couldn't memorize. He said, like, I can't memorize the lines because they're not funny enough. And he would say stuff like that. I mean, that's a joking thing he said, but he really didn't want to be there as far as time was concerned. So that did manifest itself on set.
Now, was it challenging in any way when you had to portray him in A Futile and Stupid Gesture?
Well, it did help that I knew him, and I called him in advance to warn him that I'm like, I'm going to play you in a movie. And but he was happy because it's about the life of Doug Kenny, who was a kind of like the Hamilton of comedy in the 70s, where people didn't realize what he accomplished, and then he died. And Chevy was very close with him and was very happy that he got his due. I memorized, but I watched endless hours of young Chevy Chase. and I mean, endless. And I made sure that it was a young Chevy. And I'll say, like, he was really fun to play. He was the most confident person on the planet in the 70s and 80s. And that's a fun sort of way to play a character and to be like, I'm the king of the universe. And so that was really fun. And I also mimicked his voice. I was like, he has a surprisingly deep voice. And I would scream in my trailer to lower my voice. So it was all raspy. So that was really fun to play. And David Wayne is a great director. So that was great. And Will Forte was knocked out of the park. And so, yeah, it was really fun. It was a really fun movie to make. I don't know if anybody saw it, but it was a really fun movie to make.
And I certainly enjoyed it. And I thought your portrayal of him was pretty spot on. It like captured that essence of like the Chevy Chase, like Caddyshack era, like better than anything I've ever seen. Cause that's a really challenging guy to try to capture. So my two cents, I really enjoyed that one.
I had, yes. People kept telling me, they're like, don't fuck this up. Not to.
Now, let me ask you, you know, you hinted earlier that, you know, you might be open to doing Broadway one day. Is there like a dream role that you'd either like to create or a role that you'd like to walk into? Yeah.
My Fair Lady, probably. Maybe her. No. I don't. Broadway's not going to have me. The skill level that it takes and the development of that skill level is pretty a difficult bar to you know, jump over. I would do a play there in a heartbeat. I'd love to do that. I would. You know, it's one of those things. Like, there's not a dream. Play Stanley Kowalski from Streetcar Named Desire. I would do that. But there's nothing. Boy, trying to think of a role that would just. Oh, there was a play called Fuddy Mears way back when in the 90s that I think should be brought back. It was an entire play was with a made up language between these siblings that live that never got out, and it's all kind of English, and it's freaking hilarious. So I'll do that. Fuddy Mears.
Nice. Now, Joel, one thing that we do to wrap every show is a little segment called Fastball Derby. I'd like to...
Fastball Derby. Let's do it.
All right. So I'm going to ask you a question. You say the first thing that comes to your head.
Bananas.
All right. That could actually be the answer to the first question, which was favorite New York City meal. Was it bananas? Is that your answer?
Ooh, favorite New York City meal. Well, that's a very qualified because there's so many different meals. I mean, there's so many different places. I mean, the different levels of like favorite coffee and favorite pizza. I'll say like kind of favorite high end, like favorite steakhouse. I got to go to that Cote, COTE. I think it's a Korean steakhouse. That was amazing. And then Upland is one of my favorite restaurants in New York, which for a guy from Upland, California, which is ironic because Upland is not necessarily the greatest. It makes fun of itself. It's so ugly. And I mean, like Dominique Ansel's Bakery, going there for a croissant, not even for a cronut, is one of my favorite things to do. Let's see, boy. I had great sushi there. Let's just go with Upland. Upland's great.
Baseball question. Bonds and Clemens, do you put them in the Hall of Fame?
I don't know. I mean, there's so many guys that were, you know, doing stuff to enhance themselves. Boy, I'll need to think about that. I mean, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think the Astros barely got a slap on the wrist for what they did. And then, you know, Pete Rose still can't get in the Hall of Fame and an entire team was cheating. And that the response that the fact that they weren't really punished at all was crazy. So boy, I don't know. I'm going to have to really think. I never thought, I guess, you know, my first instinct is to say no. But then the other instinct is like, no, everyone was doing it. And mostly, I mean, except I guess Griffey wasn't. And so, yeah. Boy, yeah, okay, so no.
I like that you bring that up because, you know, I'm a Yankee fan. Derek Jeter even said, you know, people like to say that it's a steroid era. Everyone was doing it. Everyone was not doing it. There were a lot of guys who went out there and did it the right way, like a Griffey, like a Jeter, or a Chipper Jones, yeah. You know, guys like that.
You know what? Yeah, I mean, ultimately, yeah, then they shouldn't. Everyone should be playing by the same rules. And I get that people are doing everything they can and they're in desperate situations, but a bunch of millionaires, yeah. Cheating? Yeah, probably shouldn't go. No, I did steroids for certain acting jobs, so I should be banned.
Oh, really? Which role? Not Jeff Winger.
No, for Chevy. Chevy Chase, I had to bulk up. So. for Spider-Man, too. I had to really, yeah. So anyway, trying to think. Yeah, anyway, that was a good question.
Thanks. All-time favorite film.
Okay, it's gotta be categories. I can't just go, well, sorry comedy or sorry drama. I can give you Dr. Strangelove is one of my favorites. Back to the Future is one of my favorites. The Holy Grail is one of my favorites. I love Do the Right Thing.
All right.
All over the map as far as like there's genres, and I think Green Room is one of the best movies ever made. There's a lot.
That's good. Between the restaurants and the films, you gave our audience a whole bunch of great options that they can check out. Yeah. You know, we could keep supporting the New York City restaurants because Joel gave you like 10 and he gave you 10 films to watch, you know, during the pandemic. So that's pretty good.
The Godfather is a masterpiece that I can't get enough of, and Requiem for a Dream is a crazy wonderful movie, and I love The Thin Red Line. I think Full Metal Jacket is also in my top three and one of the greatest endings to a movie of all time. Yeah.
How about this one? Most embarrassing onset moment.
On Community when I had to be naked playing pool and I had to lean over everyone is behind me. I'm wearing what's called a dance belt, which is basically just a thong. I've got body makeup on, but everything is exposed. And my butthole is barely covered. And my balls are basically, and I had to lean over this table and then lift my leg up. And everybody saw that shit. I did it and I was happy to do it, but I'm like, oh, this is the most exposed you have ever been on camera. So, but like, I'm trying to think of a time I'm like, well, I shit my pants. And that hasn't happened yet. I'm sure it's to come if I get to do this later in my life. So, trying to think of an embarrassing. Yeah, that's probably it.
All right. You're on a desert island. Which Broadway cast album are you taking with you?
Desert Island Has Power?
I will figure that maybe you have like one of those, maybe you have like a stereo that, you know, just has requires like AAA batteries or something like that. And you could bring the actual CD with you.
How many batteries do I have?
Let's say you're going to be there for quarantine's been like 6 months, 7 months now. So, let's say you're going to be there for like, you know, half a year, you know, and you're going to have 40 batteries, which will get you through that amount of time.
Did I break or did someone put me there? What's going on?
You're not there by choice, but you want to make the most of it. So you really want to find like a good Broadway cast album that's going to keep your spirits up because you're pissed to be there.
I want to know who put me on this island and how many batteries I'm getting and how I'm going to eat and drink.
Well, Gillian Jacobs, let's say she put you there. What you're going to eat,
power to put me on a desert island.
I don't know. Britta certainly had a lot of power over Jeff and Community, so I think she's got something working there.
Either the Book of Mormon or Hamilton.
Proudest moment of your career?
That's hard. I mean, there's like moments where I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this is happening. Like when I hosted the White House Correspondents' Dinner, or the first time I, you know, was on Letterman, or, you know, like I grew, you know, and then Conan was all on in the 90s. So I watched Conan. That was, you know, going on his show was very surreal. Getting to do a bit, like going on Kimmel and doing a bit with Matt Damon and being in a movie with Matt Damon, that was thrilling. And then, you know, like laughs on the soup, like certain times on the soup where I'm like, that was a great joke that I got to tell on television. So that was super fun. But boy, there's not like this, like I got to do a movie with Robin Williams, which was wonderful. It wasn't a great movie, but it was a really fun month and I got to hang out with him and that was just cool. I went being on Sesame Street. That was a huge highlight. So yeah, I mean, I got to have all these cool things. And so I count myself as, you know, just incredibly blessed that I got to do them. So, yeah, that's like when I got to star in a movie, I've done a couple, like I did this movie called Happily, which was has not been released, that I'm very proud of. So hopefully that will come out. You know, and even with Community, I was like, I swear I would walk in and be like, I cannot believe I'm in a show that's this good. And that's me bragging about the show that I'm on. But I was like, this writing is fucking great. And I knew it was great while we were doing it. So yeah, that's a long answer again. There you go.
All right. Lastly, Joel, what's the best piece of advice anyone ever gave you?
I don't know. Fuck shit up. I think it was learning how to, learning a work ethic. And I learned that pretty much in football. And for me, it's like, and it's probably too American because I don't relax. But it was just like, oh, if you want to do anything, you need to work hard. Sounds so dumb, but I knew so many actors that were better than me that didn't put in the time and gave up. And I think one of the reasons why I have continued to get jobs is because I am unrelenting. So just work hard. That's because it's where you learn who you are and all that while you're in the valleys, while you're doing the work to get to the, you know, the top of the mountain. Thank you.
Thank you, Joel. This was awesome. Such a pleasure. All right, folks. Very much appreciate you listening tonight. This is Al Malafronte signing off for the Broadway Podcast Network. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Break a Bat. This is produced by the fine folks at the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit and subscribe at bpn.fm/breakabat. You can find me online at break_a_bat_podcast. And you can also find the Broadway Podcast Network on Instagram at Broadway Podcast Network. It's been so great having you here with us today, and we'll see you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. and there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.